These past several weeks, our newspapers have been full of news of the renaissance of Nazism in Germany. In the third state election, the National Democratic Party, the neo-Nazi party of Germany, again won significant representation. The party faithful gathered this last week in Hanover for a great convention where they sang Deutschland über alles, raised their clenched fist to race and to nation, and where fiery speeches were made, not demanding not only the reunification of Germany, but the reuniting to Germany of German minorities and German oppressed minorities in Poland and Hungary, in Austria. And those of us with long historical memories could not but recall 1936 and 1937, Nuremberg, the Anschluss. And it proved to us again, if indeed we needed proof, that the hates of mankind and his black dreams are as resilient as man's great dreams and highest aspirations. In the new pure, Adolf von Fadden brought out all the paranoia of the German people, all their blackest emotions and deepest hates. Indeed, there was only one item which had not been on the original item, the original curriculum of the first Führer. And that was that at this convention, the speakers were not allowed to mount the rostrum and spew forth the venom of anti-Semitism. But lest we feel relieved that there has been a change of heart, this was a tactical decision. Von Fadden had apparently decided that the world would accept German nationalism and German imperialism, the folk and the race, but that the world could not yet stomach talk of the concentration camps and the crematoria. But there was no speech which was anti-Semitic. The magazines and the periodicals of the National Democratic Party have been filled with this familiar venom. Last summer, one of the men who has come to the front as one of the new Hitler's professors, Herr Dr. P.V. Bormann, wrote an article in the Nation of Europe, one of the non-neo-Nazi magazines, in which he tried to explain how it was that this mongrel people, the Jews, could win such a clear, clean war as they did in June. We were a people who genetically, according to the master race theory, were pliant and suppliant. We had no guts, we had no courage. How could Israel have won the war? And Mr. Bormann's answer had at least the virtue of simplicity. His logic lay in this, that the Israelis are not Jews. The Israelis are not the descendants of the peddlers and the hunchbacks of Europe so familiar from the Nazi stereotype. Rather, they are the descendants of fellow Huns, of a barbarian tribe, the Khazars, which converted from heathenism to Judaism in the 9th century in their Cossack Caucasus homeland. And so he looked upon the June war not as a Jewish victory, not as the defeat of danger, a threat, but rather as another proof that the white race must ultimately win out over the mixed peoples. The phrases and the pejoratives, I hasten to add, are his own, and not, of course, mine. Now here we have proof, if proof again we need, that the black hates of mankind are resilient, and that man can invent and then come to believe the most incredible rationalizations for their shadowy purposes. Now, I cite this Nazi experience not to speak this morning of Nazism, for that is not my purpose. I speak of Israel and of the possibility of peace in the Middle East. But because I want to make an extrapolation, and I want to suggest simply this, that if after a total defeat, if after worldwide discredit, if after every nation and every politician has found it necessary to turn his back or his nation's back on all that Nazism stood for, if Nazism has the ability to recreate itself, to draw the shattered pieces together, to come back to life, what shall we say about the black dream of the Arabs, which was defeated in a quick war, to be sure, but in a war whose cutting edge was blunted by instant rearmament and by the willingness of many of the nations of the world to listen again to Arab complaint and to do again the Arab bidding, because behind that bidding lay oil and markets and geopolitical advantage. Israel won a victory on the battlefield beginning on the 5th of June. Beginning on the 10th of June, the nations of the world undid that victory. For they did not allow the Arab nations to dwell on it, on their defeat, to accept the simple fact that they have been beaten, bloodied, routed. In Israel in June and July, the peoples used a phrase from our Bible. They said, Hayinu kacholmim. We were as dreamers. And by this they described that immensity of relief, that sense of walking on air, the overwhelming euphoria which had come to them after the threat to their jugular had been removed. Well, in another sense, the Arabs, for the last generations, have been dreamers, except they have been dreaming nightmares, red dreams. Dreams of marching into Israel on a carpet of blood. Dreams of driving the Yishuv into the sea. Dreams of destroying the Jewish state. And they have walked about with this dream, and they have dreamt of carrying out these nightmares. And three times they have precipitated a war. And three times thousands of their men have died in battle. Tens of thousands of their families have been made homeless. And tens of millions of dollars have been poured down the drain in fictitious military undertaking. Monies desperately needed for food and for clothing and for shelter and for schooling, for the basics of life in these desperately poor countries, which are without any of the modern amenities for the masses. The June War might have been that douche of cold water which shakes the Arabs awake, which forces them to open their eyes, to see the daylight, to admit reality, to see that Israel is not a crusader state, foreign military peoples who have come to the Middle East and squatted there, who can be hectored and harried and ultimately driven home. That this is an indigenous people with long ties to the land, and that this is their home, their only home, and their legitimate home. The Arabs could have been shocked, for war is a form of shock treatment, shocked into the realization that here was a military power they could not defeat, and that it was pointless and fruitless to enter again that escalation cycle of raids and economic pressures and attack and ultimately provocation and war itself. But the tragedy of July, the tragedy of August, and the tragedy of September and October and of this month has been that there were powers in the world which said to the Arabs, sleep on, dream on. In June, Egypt's army lay strewn over the Sinai Desert, charred tanks, destroyed planes. The Syrian army had left behind its armaments in the bunkers on the Golan Heights. The best of the Jordanian legion's equipment lay here and yon in the West Bank. And then in June, Russia promised new arms and made good on that promise, and within a week after the armistice was announced, the first of the armada of Russian freighters was at the port of Alexandria and unloading at Port Said. 80% of the equipment lost by Egypt and by Syria has been returned to their arsenal. More expensive equipment, more sophisticated equipment, more powerful equipment. Faster jet planes, the MiG-21 instead of the MiG-19. Heavier army, heavy-duty tanks, the T-35 instead of the T-55. Not only ground-to-air missiles as before, but ground-to-ground missiles as never before. 5 months after an absolute defeat, the Egyptian army has greater firepower today than it had in May of this year. The Arabs were told by Russian act, dream on. What have you lost? A worthless officer corps, a few tanks which we can replace, a few guns, a few planes. Hit our back. Dream on. Begin again. A defeat could have forced the rude awakening, but it did not. The Arab nations were rearmed. But perhaps over a slightly longer period, the economic cost of the war might have shocked the Arabs into reality. Because breadlines, domestic need, political unrest, these have a way of bringing out a new leadership, and men who are willing to take a new look at things. Egypt, long before June, was tottering on the edge of bankruptcy. Their economy was a shamble. The World Bank would no longer lend them money. They had bartered their cotton good for armaments credits to China and to Russia. The Fellaheen were actually far worse off in 1966 than they had been 10 years before in the second year of their social revolution. The rate of population growth and Nasser's imperialistic ambitions had created a drain on the social reform so that the population explosion ate up whatever new industry, whatever new productive power Egypt now had. Syria was bankrupt. There were serious economic dislocations attendant to this war. But what happened? Russia hastened to Damascus and to Cairo and offered credits. The Arab states drew together Khartoum in what was bruited about to be a convention of moderates. And what did they do? They voted, shall we call it alimony, to Egypt and to Jordan, regular routine monthly payments from oil royalties to keep their economies going. These countries were not to suffer because of their defeat. They were to be protected and to be encouraged. Foreign aid, Soviet aid, Arab aid, all of these have conspired to convince the Arabs that they can weather the economic price of this war, that they can wage war without real structural damage to their economy. And so no one was really surprised when at the same Khartoum conference the end resolution read, among other things, quote, there can be no peace with Israel, there can be no negotiation with Israel, there can be no recognition of Israel, end of quote. When you can enter a war and court defeat, and know that all will be made good in short order, there is no reason to seek to stabilize an area, to bring the reality of security to one part of the globe. And so the Arabs were rearmed, and the Arabs were refinanced, and they were told, dream on, dream your nightmare dreams. And they were told this not only militarily and financially, but politically. Immediately the armistice was in effect, the United Nations began to seek a formula for peace. Immediately the armistice was in operation, the United Nations began to speak of what? Of a return of the Middle East to the conditions before the war. Immediately the diplomats of the world forgot the provocation, the threat, the years of El Fateh, a terrorist attack. Immediately they forgot their own impotency before the Arab noose as it was tightened around Israel. And immediately their concern became the narrow legalistic concern of returning the world to what it had been before Humpty Dumpty had sat on his wall and had his great fall. And in the United Nations, Israel has one vote, one voice, and the 14 nations that went to war on Israel have 13 votes and 13 voices. And the Arabs know that if there ever should be a chas v'chalila, God forbid, a spirit of worldwide conscience, and the world body should begin to put together a package, a peace package, which speaks of security, which speaks of completely of the rights of free and innocent passage and waterways, which speaks of large demilitarized zones, which speaks of an armaments control for the Middle East, and Russia has a veto in the Security Council and will quickly undo any attempt of the world to bring peace. The United Nations, in effect, in reality, promises the Arab world that they can attack Israel again and again and again, and each time if the attack fails, somehow the legal machinery, the endless debate, the logic splitting, will allow them to come back in time, in 6 months or a year's time, to the original borders, to the jumping-off places from which marauders attack Israel, to the airfields from which their jets can, within 5 minutes, dump a load of warheads on Tel Aviv, from the missile silos where the missiles can be at their ready. The United Nations is a place in which the Arabs can hope to undo any damage caused by the war. It is a place in which those who pay an economic price for the war, the Englands of the world, England, as we're told, spending $70 million a month in much needed currency because of the closing of the Suez Canal, where the Englands of the world and where the West Germanys of the world can cloak their economic interest in grand and noble words about peace and adjustment and compromise and no one being too bellicose and belligerent. The United Nations is a place where old political debts can be paid and new political arrangements can be made, in which a France can show a Russia that she is willing to go along. The United Nations is a place in which the hard realities of the Cold War can be worked out in intricate and complex antagonisms, in which Russia can get a pound of flesh because of the United States' involvement in Vietnam by opposing Israel in the Middle East, in which the United States, because of its preoccupation with Vietnam, finds that it must walk a delicate, moderate balance and cannot speak out fully and completely in understanding of Israel's case. The United Nations is a place in which the long hand of Rome can be seen. Rome's ancient desire to internationalize Jerusalem, a desire which has not been affected, but which each new turbulence in the Middle East allows Rome, through the Latin American states, other states, to seek to bring about. The United Nations is a place in which the diplomats of the world can cancel out the instinctive reaction of the peoples of the world that David had a right to defeat Goliath, that a peace-loving people has a right to stand up against a threat to their very life itself, and begin the intricate, complex, world maneuvering which seeks to bring about adjustments to the largest power, to the force majeure, in which they can forget and overlook the needs of a little state. The United Nations is a place where the Secretariat itself is responsible in part for the war, in which those troops of the United Nations that were on the borders between Israel and Egypt were not of clean hands, where there is evidence that they did in fact cooperate with the country in which they were stationed, where the United Nations Secretariat is afraid to speak out openly of the need for direct confrontation, where the Security Council's head himself, Mr. Ufant, has spoken out about what he calls the unrealistic hope of Israel for direct negotiation between Israel and her neighbors. So here again we have the blunting of the effect of the war. Here again we have help given to the Arab states by states which have their own positions in the Cold War, by states which have heavy Muslim minorities, by states which want to enter into the markets of the Middle East. Here we have all manner of pressure directed against little Israel, pressure which is of an economic and political and ideological nature. Here there is the very real hope for the Arabs that 1956 will repeat itself, that world pressure will force Israel to retreat from her advance without the hard guarantees of security which she requires. The tragedy of 1967 is that the Arabs were not allowed to accept the simple statement, we were beaten, we were defeated, we were routed. We need to come to grips with new projects, new hopes, a different attitude towards coexistence in the Middle East. Instead, they were encouraged to dream on the ghastly, gray dreams of military attack. And proof of this, if proof you need, lies not only in the shelling which periodically occurs across the Jordan or the Suez, nor does it lie particularly in the attack by the Aussa missile ship of the Egyptians and the Israeli destroyer, the Eilat, which sunk it. Nor does it exist in the presence of the Soviet military fleet within 13 miles of Israeli gun emplacement. Rather, it lies in the statements of the so-called moderate among the Arab leaders, King Hussein, who rushed to this country a week ago to talk of compromise, to offer adjustment. There was an opportunity to dicker, to work out, to negotiate. And then he went before a select audience at Georgetown University. And what did this moderate say? He said that the only hope for peace in the Middle East lay in the dissolution of Israel and the absorption of its inhabitants under Arab governments. He showed in that speech that all the so-called compromises of the Arab world are in fact smokescreens designed to gain time, designed to allow the Arabs to dream on and plan on the final wars of liberation, as they call it. Oil, population, geopolitics, economic markets, ancient hates, the Cold War, the timidity of diplomats and their lack of basic human instinctive response to events, all of this has conspired to blunt the defeat and to make peace well nigh impossible in the Middle East. Is there then any hope for peace in this embattled corner of the world? Yes, there's a dim one, but it's dim indeed. And it depends not upon the diplomats of the world or the political machinery of the world, not upon the United Nations voting some kind of resolution. It depends upon one fact and one fact only: the ability of Israel to stand firm. The ability of Israel to stay at the present boundaries and to say, we will not retreat a single inch until we have the ironclad guarantees which are necessary to our existence. Such intransigence alone offers any hope of peace in the Middle East. The minute Israel collapses its front, the minute Israel says, yes, we will negotiate and gives in before those guarantees are fixed and are certain and are unbreakable, then the hope of peace in the Middle East goes down the drain, because there will be, surely, a fourth round. If Israel can remain firm in the face of increased Russian truculence, remain firm in the face of economic pressure from many of the nations of Western Europe, and remember that Israel needs markets in Western Europe, remain firm in the face of the so-called peaceniks of our world, who said not a word when Israel was being attacked daily by marauders and terrorists, but who, when Israel defended her very life, suddenly spoke of the fact that war cannot be used to settle international disputes. Only if Israel can remain firm, only then is there a hope for peace. A firmness retains for Israel its bargaining power. It retains whatever cutting edge of this defeat is left. Jordan has lost to markets. Jordan has lost to tourists. Egypt has lost her canal. Syria has lost her southern heights. Land has been lost. Crops have been lost. Budget profit has been lost. And there will be a time when other nations will cease to want to make up for the Arab losses. There may be a time when nations will cease to want to build up again the Arab armies. There certainly will be a time when the Arabs now within Israel, Israeli hegemony, will begin to stand up for their own rights. For mark you, the Palestinians, so-called Jordanians of the West Bank, were never intended to be part of Jordan. Jordan has no claims west of the river. The original partition provisions of the 1947 United Nations decisions talked of an independent Palestinian state. And the Arab leaders of Palestine, of the West Bank today, are beginning to talk again in these terms. The longer that Israel waits, the more possibilities arise. The more chances there are for buffer states, for demilitarized zones. The more countervailing pressures begin in the Arab world to destroy that unity, that fragile unity which is based only upon the single desire to drive out Israel, the old jihad, the old drive towards what is called a holy war. There are ancient enmities between the revolutionary states and the royalist states, between the Hashemite house and the Egyptian house. There are ancient bitternesses between the oil-producing states and the poor states which have no oil. There are great bitternesses between those emirs and sheikhs who have grabbed power and their brothers, emir and sheikhs, who are without power. There is a battle between the communists and the non-communists within the Arab world. There is a traditional battle between Egypt and the Tigris-Euphrates area. All these tensions and frictions do exist. And as long as Israel remains firm, there is the hope that the Arab world will shatter and break apart, and there will become a living room in which to breathe and in which to negotiate. You know, it's interesting to me that the peace-loving peoples of the world said not a word in 1948 about the Jordanian conquest of the West Bank, about the need to withdraw and to pull back to the Jordan River and allow the Palestinians to have their own state. But when Israel comes to the West Bank in defense of its own life, then they begin to talk of withdrawal. It's interesting to me that as long as the Egyptians held the Gaza Strip, which was never intended to be part of Egypt and never has been part of Egypt, which was to be a demilitarized zone, As long as the Egyptians held the Gaza Strip, nobody talked about the withdrawal of the Egyptian authority, the withdrawal of Egyptian troops, even though everybody knew that this narrow strip of coastal land was a jumping-off place for attack on Israel. But only when Israel has conquered this land do people talk of pulling back, of withdrawal. I wonder about the equity of it all. I wonder how people can really believe that Israel, the most realist of all the countries of that era, can think of withdrawal. A withdrawal from Gaza, from this arrow of land which points at its coastal road. Withdrawal from Sinai, where the jet bases are within minutes of any target in Israel. Withdrawal from the West Bank, from whose heights howitzer guns can rain down shells on the coastal highway. Withdrawal from the Golan. Such a withdrawal would, of course, again make the Galilean settlements sitting ducks for the Egyptian, for the Syrian gunners. Or even withdrawal from Jerusalem. Withdrawal from the sacred places and the graveyards of our people. In the full knowledge that having withdrawn, they would again be desecrated and contemned. The only hope of peace, and it's a dim hope, is for Israel to remain firm and steadfast, and to await that time when the nations of the world are willing to say to the Arabs, not dream on, but wake up. When they are willing to say to Nasser and to Hussein and to Yidad, we've had it. We can no longer afford your reckless ambitions. We can no longer afford the arms race in the Middle East. We can no longer afford to have an eyeball-on-eyeball confrontation between East and West. We need peace and we need security. You can live with Israel. Israel can be of great benefit to you. Her skills, her manpower, her trade. Learn to live with reality. Learn to accept the Israeli roots as they have accepted yours. Turn your attention and your concern away from arms and guns and wars to the real war. The war against disease, the war against poverty, the war against the blight, the war against the destruction of your own nation. For Egypt is falling further and further behind in the race to become a technological power. The people are eating up the new agricultural output far faster than can be produced. The gross national product cannot keep up in its rate of growth with the population. Israel is falling farther and farther behind into a have-not nation status. And this rate will be geometrically compounded as long as Nasser and the leaders continue to fight in Yemen, to plan against Israel, to dream of an Egyptian hegemony over North Africa, over the Middle East, and over Central Africa. Only if Israel stands firm is there a chance for peace. And I was pleased to read this last week Israel's decision in this regard. Mr. Abi Ibn's statement, clear, brief, and concise statement to the United Nations. It is Israel's firm resolve never to return to the danger and vulnerability from which we have emerged. This resolve will prevail over every other consideration. To avoid a return to any of the conditions which prevailed on June 4 is a supreme national purpose worthy of every effort and any consequence. And to this, we can only say, Chazak ve'ematz, be strong, be of good courage, and so far as we can, we will stand with you. Our dream as yours must be the dream of peace. And we know that the guardian of Israel, who neither sleeps nor slumbers, wills peace. And that with your courage and with the support of men of goodwill throughout the world, there may yet be some hope for the Middle East. war is short, peace will be long in coming. The battle was swift, peace is delayed. But peace there can be. If we do not buckle in, if Israel does not buckle in her resolve, and if we continue as best we can, the freedom-loving peoples of the world, to voice our understanding and to show in tangible ways our support.